and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagmann Report. Today is Tuesday, October 17th, 2017. Joe Hagmann here, your co-host, along with Doug Hagmann, who is off this evening. Well, when I say off, I just mean he is not doing this show, but he might be checking in. I'm not sure. We have a great lineup for you today, a full schedule, and a diversity of topics that we're going to get into. First guest we have coming up with us is Guy Smith. His website is gunfacts.info. He's a big gun guy, and folks, check out his site. It's awesome. He's got so much stuff up there. He's an author. He also has a free PDF on the website, Gunfacts version 7.0, returning honesty to the gun control debate, is what that is about. And we're going to get into a number of discussions about the Second Amendment, gun control, the politics surrounding gun control, and maybe we're going to get his opinion on what happened in Las Vegas. Then, in hour two, we have, from NoMoreFakeNews.com, John Rappaport, and he's going to be joining us, as he has several times in the past, to talk about a number of issues, from the investigation into Las Vegas to the medical tyranny, which he talked about last time he was on. And then in hour three, we had a last-minute change. Stan Deo joins us each Tuesday in the third hour. But Stan is doing some hard work, and he is unable to join us tonight. So instead, in hour three, we're going to be joined by Pastor Mike Spaulding, host of Soaring Eagle Radio, and we're going to talk about a number of things. He's fresh off of a conference, and he wants to talk about hope and where the church is going from here. Well, with us is our first guest, excuse me, Mr. Guy Smith. He's a writer, a songwriter, a political provocateur, and he has been referred to as a libertarian with a foreign policy. And he has written a book, as well as the Gunfacts PDF on the website. The book he wrote is Shooting the Bull. And we're going to talk about this book, as well as many other things pertaining to gun control, the Second Amendment, and the politics about it. Mr. Smith, welcome to the Hagmann Report.
Pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you, and I got to give a thank you to our tech, Eric the Tech, my first time I'm going to say this on air, my new brother-in-law, for finding Guy Smith. Eric, I don't know what it is you were looking through, and you he caught your attention, but through an article on Drudge. Okay, well, yeah, this was Eric found Mr. Smith, and again, the website, gunfacts.info. Everybody go there and bookmark this site. It's an awesome site. I've been playing around with it for the last hour. And at the bottom of the page there, you can look at the book, Shooting the Bull. And it looks like it's a great book. Obviously, I haven't read it, but it is something that I am interested in. And we're still on the heels of Las Vegas, Mr. Smith. I saw on your blog, you did a piece on your website, Las Vegas Perspectives, and you go through a number of things that bothered you with Las Vegas. Where do you want to start today, Mr. Smith?
Well, you know, Las Vegas is the story of the day, and there's a lot of interesting side notes to that. The one that I'm still waiting for, the official police report, any indication of the shooter's motives that will inform us not only about why he may have wanted to do this, but also his mental health condition, since we see a high correlation between people with mental health problems and any type of mass murder. So those things still waiting on. But to my mind, the interesting thing about this event, and it was quite unlike many mass murders, is the amount of dedicated planning that went went into it, he was very much looking for what I'm calling a cattle pen opportunity. He was looking for a situation where the victims were packed in so tightly that he was going to be guaranteed a high body count regardless of what kind of weapon he used, because the victims were basically immobile. There was no way to escape. I looked at the statistics for the venue and the ticket reports, and basically the venue was designed to hold 22,000 people, and they had just around 22,000 people. And I'm sure all of your listeners have been to a nice, big, healthy, well-packed concert and know that you're rubbing elbows to elbows with perfect strangers, and that in a really good concert, especially if you're in that front row, you can't move an inch. And that's exactly what the shooter was looking for. He had scoped out two previous venues, and he wanted that packed, confined space so that no matter where he flung a bullet, it was going to hit somebody.
Yeah, and you also in your article on Las Vegas, you say that you believe that the most kills happened in the first few minutes of the shooting because that they were all packed together the way they were, and kind of had to be bottlenecked out of there to leave the venue. And that's because it's called spray and pray, that the shooter, that's the technique he would use. He obviously wasn't aiming specifically at one person at a time taking shots. He was just indiscriminately firing into a crowd. And when you have the amount of people, as you just described, elbow to elbow with each other, those first, rounds of fire where everybody is next to each other are going to be that's where you're going to see the most casualties. That's what you're saying, correct?
That's my suspicion. And I've seen a couple of, comments by police officers who have been investigating the scene, and a couple of them have said that most of the deaths that they're able to triangulate, happened early in the massacre. And it all makes, rational sense when you think through how the crowd reacts the moment that people start dropping. Because people are going to a good duck, they're going to try to find whatever cover they can, even if it's behind another concert goer. And so the first people to get hit are much more likely to sustain life-ending physical trauma from the bullets. So, yeah, I believe most of the dead are probably going to be registered as early kills.
Okay, and Guy, I want to ask you this, because this is one thing that's been bothering me about this event. When, obviously, you're very, very familiar with firearms, you're a firearms expert, where the shooter was positioned and the amount of cell phone and other video we have seen of the events that unfolded in Las Vegas that night, are you surprised that we do not see the muzzle flashes from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay?
Not exceptionally, no. I have not looked in detail at the firearms that he was using, but a lot of common sporting arms of the variety that he was looking or using that day come with certain muzzle brakes on them, certain flash suppressing technology. And quite frankly, when you're looking straight towards where the bullets are coming from, you don't see as much muzzle flash as you would if you were looking at it, from the side. So add to that the mirrored reflective glass that was on the building and all the bright lights that are up and down the Las Vegas Strip. It wouldn't surprise me at all that no one is going to latch on to a specific point from that specific window and be able to tell that those were muzzle burst up 32 floors.
Okay. Yeah, because that's one of the things that bothered me, at least. And I've seen a lot of videos. I've been watching them at, the .25 speed, and I have found one where it does appear to show muzzle flashes from up at the top of the Mandalay Bay. It's very faint, though, but I was just, I don't know a whole lot about guns, especially what it looks like at nighttime, having that kind of fire, that kind of firepower. But I guess I just expected that you would expect to see, big, bright flashes almost with every shot, but I guess that's not the case. Let's move on to the bump stocks, because this is something else you point out in your article, is that potentially the weapons that were fitted with the bump stocks, those bump stocks actually helped him kill more people than he would be able to without those. Is that correct?
Well, we can't be sure about that. I've seen people who, with a fairly small amount of training, can take a stock AR-15 or civilian version of an AK-47 and squeeze off rounds at an amazing rate. So in terms of the total body count, especially considering the cattle pinning situation that we're in, I'm not sure it really made all that much difference. It certainly was part of his planning, though. You can tell that that was integral to him wanting to put as many bullets into the field as possible. But whether it made a substantial difference in the total body count or not, you know, would be hard to say.
Okay. And then the last question I want to ask you, I'm not sure how much you know about the reports of the fuel tanks being targeted and a few bullet holes being found in these aviation fuel tanks at the airport, and that led investigators, including the sheriff, to say that they believed he was trying to spark an explosion by shooting these fuel tanks. And I didn't know with the weaponry he had and the distance where he was, if he would be able to do that, if that's even possible. And I'm not sure how closely you followed that, but
yeah, as a matter of fact, I was very intrigued by that, because one of the first things that we saw, even before we heard about the fuel tank reports, was that he had busted out two windows, and looking at the angles of the windows on the building, it didn't make a whole lot of sense why he busted out the second one. So when we heard that bullets were lobbed into the fuel tanks, and then later we also heard some field reports that he had been shopping around for tracer rounds as part of the process, then it became apparent to me that he had the idea in his head that a tracer round shot into the fuel tank could cause an explosion. I read a report from somebody in the aviation business that basically said no, the type of fuel in that tank was not going to go up, even if you did hit it with an incendiary round. That's above my pay grade. I don't know whether that's true or not. But the fact was, it seemed like that was part of his planning. He wanted to buy the tracer rounds, he busted out the second window, and he fired directly into those fuel tanks, which is interesting, because one of the things I like to point out to people is that humans have been committing mass murder since the caveman days. It doesn't take a particular amount of talent to kill a lot of people. In fact, one of my favorite examples was this fellow in China just a couple of years ago, got good and mad at his wife and mother-in-law, grabbed a kitchen knife, and in 5 minutes not only murdered them, but murdered, I think, seven other random people as he walked down the street. And he did this all in just a matter of 4 or 5 minutes. So this fellow, Paddock, not only thought through the cattle pinning situation and how many people he could possibly kill there, but he wanted to see if he could also set off a Oklahoma City-grade bombing of the airport and that little corner of Las Vegas at the same time. This was a man who was really going out for a steep, steep body count. And all I can say is that, you know, I'm kind of grateful he didn't do enough research on the fuel tanks, and, you know, that would have caused him to think of some other method of creating a huge explosion.
Yeah, I heard estimates that said that if he was able to carry out the rest of his plan and detonate those fuel tanks, that we would be seeing death tolls into the thousands. And, you know, thank the Lord that that did not happen. And for whatever reason, the shooter, Paddock, stopped shooting and apparently killed himself. A lot of these a lot of what happened is still unclear, as it's not been verified by the police department. I guess last question on Vegas, Guy, are you satisfied with the level of information and the that has come out from the police department? I mean, I'll just tell you how I feel. We haven't seen any CCTV footage of the hallway or Paddock in the, you know, coming and going from the casino. We haven't. There's just so much we haven't seen. We don't know where the security guard is. We haven't been given a list of who was killed by what bullets. What were the different bullets that were used or by the survivors that they were taken out of. There's no accurate count on how many shots were fired. Some of the just the basic things you think they would be able to put out there as factual pretty much immediately or within the days, a few days after the shooting, are not there. Does that bother you at all, or do you think that's still forthcoming?
I think it's still forthcoming. Collaborated with a number of law enforcement, married into a cop family, and I've even met a couple of people in Las Vegas PD. An investigation of this scale never goes quickly, and a smart police department is going to try to get all of their facts absolutely right before they, make any strong public statement. And it would not surprise me if they spent a good couple of months analyzing everything before, releasing some of the data that you outlined. And it's frustrating as heck, especially for somebody like me who studies these situations down to two decimal places. I want that data and I want it yesterday, but it's not unreasonable for a police department dealing with something this catastrophic to take their time.
Yeah, I obviously want to give the investigators the time to be able to compile the information and do it in a proper manner, using standard operating procedures of investigative techniques. So when they release it is accurate. I just have a problem with how the investigation was co-opted by the FBI, and it wasn't just the local FBI, the Vegas FBI. The chief commander there was relieved of his duties, and you had Andrew McCabe come in to run the investigation. And this whole thing just stinks to me, but we are still in the middle of this investigation, but I'm not too hopeful that more info will come out. Well, Guy, if you want to switch gears here, where do you want to go next? Do you want to talk about the attempted gun control that came out of Las Vegas from the news media and the politicians who every time they have the opportunity to cry for gun control and the Second Amendment to be attacked? I saw a quote of yours. And it said, "No civil right has come under such unrelenting attacks as the Second Amendment. Everyone who takes liberty seriously must actively defend the Second Amendment." And that's so true. But after Las Vegas, one thing I thought that was interesting is many of the people who were survivors, you didn't hear one person who was the victim of Las Vegas say, guns need to be banned. And I thought that was pretty interesting. So the media kind of moved from complete gun control to, the control of bump stocks and these other accessories. What do you think happened? Do you think that the media just let it go, the gun control issue, or they didn't think that this was actually a good spot to throw this issue out at the public?
That's a darn good question. The gun control industry got knocked back on their heels several times by playing stupid games. And one of the stupid games that they played, and you saw a few of them try to play it this time, but the stupid game that they play is that they jump out the second that a body hits the ground and they start proposing whatever the gun control legislation de jure is. And the media, or at least, the politically active media on the pro-control side, got caught several times doing the same thing. And what happens invariably is that once the facts of the case start to come out, then you discover that everything that was proposed is just silliness. In fact, I think it was about 4 or 5 days after the event, I felt this desire to pick up the phone and dial in and find out what the weather report in hell was, because Dianne Feinstein, of all people, in front of the media said, "Well, there's no legislation that would have stopped this." And I tell you what, I just about had a cardiac arrest when I heard her say that, because she's the unholy goddess of the entire gun control industry. So I think what's happened is that people on the pro-control side have gotten smarter. They're getting more savvy about how to play the game. And what happened in this particular case, once the issue of bump stocks came out, was that they had a new issue that they felt that they could wrap everybody around on. I mean, even the National Rifle Association has come out and said, "Well, maybe we got to rethink, whether bump stocks should be part of NFA or not." And so that shows some savvy on their part. They waited. They found the hook. They're running with the hook that has general public support to it.
Yeah. You know, I would agree with you that the gun control lobby is getting smarter. It's obvious that their attempts to, you know, gain political points on the backs of tragedies, the way that they were going about it, was not working. And I know for a fact that no matter how they try to repackage it, there is a great percentage of the American people that will never go for it. Those American people are the ones who are gun owners, who have been hunters, and you know, more self-reliant and so than other people. And it seems, though, that we have two types of people in America today, where we have the people who do believe in the Second Amendment, who do believe in the right to bear arms, and that there should not be any, you know, it doesn't restrict that to a muzzle loader, that we should be able to have, you know, any kind of weaponry that are out there. Then you have the other type of American citizen who believes that we should not have the right to bear arms, and they think that the part of the Second Amendment that talks about, you know, having guns to protect ourselves against governments, about against tyrannical governments, is lunacy. They think it, you know, it's basically a conspiracy theory. And it seems that the percentage of people who are on the side of the Second Amendment, pro-Second Amendment, seems to be growing. But it also seems to be growing, or at least the appearance of the anti-Second Amendment people seem to be growing. What do you think? How do you think that gun divide in our country works?
Well, first, long-term trends have been more towards the pro-gun side. Looking at public polling from Gallup and Pew and a few other places, we saw a steep decline through the 1990s of people who favored various forms of gun control, especially handgun bans. And what I think precipitated this more than anything else was the grand experiment that we have had in this country. From back in 1998, there were 10, count them, 10 states that allowed for concealed carry of handguns in public. And in 1998, the legislation was passed in Florida, the first large state with a, you know, diverse population and major metro centers. They became a shall-issue concealed carry state. And when nobody died in the process, then other states started falling. So anyway, we've gone from 10 states to 42 states that allow for some form of concealed carry. Either on a shall issue basis or in a few states where they don't require you to be licensed whatsoever. And nothing happened. And I think a lot of people watched this experiment. You know, they were probably terrified when their state flipped, and after a year or two of their state being shall issue and probably having a couple of friends who ran out and got their concealed carry permit and nobody dying in the process, a lot of people kind of said, okay, well, you know, this isn't so bad, and maybe I'll talk to Bob and find out about getting a revolver for the nightstand. So I think it was an evolutionary thing that's been going on. Interestingly, when Michael Bloomberg ran out of, you know, people to abuse in New York, he decided to go out to the rest of the country, and he is spending tons of money to try to shape public opinion going back the other way. Thankfully, he's been relatively unsuccessful at it. And I think that's why we see the divide. America generally is becoming more pro-gun, definitely more pro-Second Amendment. But the money behind the other side is increasing. They're improving their game. They're getting their messaging tighter. They're finding better ways of doing propaganda. And that figures in prominently to why they look bigger than they are. And one quick point, you know, you were talking about the Second Amendment and the way people perceive it. Here's a very interesting little tidbit. The Heller decision of 2008, that's when the Supreme Court again, and they've done it multiple times, certified that the right to bear arms was an individual right. And it was a 5-4 decision. But what's interesting is that when you read the dissenting opinions, none of the dissenting opinions argued against the individual right. What they were attempting to do in the dissenting opinions was to make it a lesser right, but they never argued that it wasn't an individual right. So Technically speaking, it was a 9-0 decision in favor of the individual right to own guns. And that's one thing which I want everyone to keep in mind, whether you're pro-gun or anti-gun, but especially if you're pro-gun talking to somebody who's anti-gun, whip that on them. You know, a unanimous Supreme Court decision, basically, that you have a right to own a gun.
Very interesting. Folks, our guest is Guy Smith. His website is gunfacts.info. That's gunfacts.info. He is an author. He also has a free ebook on his website on the right-hand side called Gun Facts, Returning Honesty to the Gun Control Debate. And this free ebook is over 100 pages of indexed information divided into chapters based on gun control topics. And I'm going to download it myself right now and use this as a resource and check it out. I advise everybody to do that, as well as getting Mr. Smith's book, Shooting the Bull. And we're going to talk about the book in just a little bit. I want to ask you about your last blog post, Guy Smith, Unscientific American, More Guns Do Not Stop More Crimes, Evidence Shows. Let's talk about this study a little bit, because we hear very often, and we've seen this new phenomenon in this country over the last 10, 20 years, of what we call gun-free zones. And many people who travel a lot have seen, you know, hotels that they attempt to enter, or different businesses that have, you know, no weapon policies, where they say you're not allowed to, even if you legally own and legally conceal carry a weapon, you are not allowed per their policy to have it in their establishment. And we see that a lot of violence happens in these gun-free zones, and Chicago is a great example of, you know, a very liberal city with very strict gun control laws, yet they have some of the most worst gun violence in the whole nation. But here you're looking at a study that says more guns do not stop more crimes, when we know the opposite to be true, that the more people that have guns, that the more crime decreases. But what is this study, explain to our listeners how this study tries to make the case that more guns does not equate to less crime.
Well, this has been one of my favorites. And to dial this back a little bit, first, thank you for mentioning Shooting the Bull. For your listeners, Shooting the Bull is a guide to propaganda analysis. I use the gun control industry as my case study throughout the entire book, side effect of studying the whole process for 16 years. And the ways that you can lie to people through propaganda are amazing. There are many. They're very multifaceted. And what happened in Scientific American recently was that somebody published an article which was a wonderful example of how to cherry-pick data in order to make a statement that is completely inaccurate. So one of the main points that the author made in her article was that guns are not often used to prevent crimes, which comes as a big surprise to everyone in the criminology field, because they've been studying this for a long time and they have a different opinion on it. So what happened, to give you an example of how people can mislead, most people who cite the frequency with which defensive gun use, DGUs, occur, cite a study that was done by a criminologist by the name of Gary Kleck. Gary Kleck also wrote a book called Targeting Guns, which is, I think, mandatory reading for anyone who's fascinated by the subject. So what the author did was she took Kleck's study, which basically said guns are used 2.5 million times a year to prevent crimes, and then she pulled one other study out and said, but this study says it only happens 65,000 times. You know, that's a huge disparity. What she failed to do, and I have to assume that this was intentional, was that she didn't mention in Gary Kleck's own book that he presented a table with, I think it was 10 different studies performed by criminologists, performed by public polling outfits like Gallup and Pew, and also by media outlets like the LA Times. And all of those studies centered around that 2.5 million mark. There were a couple outliers on the high and the low end, but, you know, when you ignore those and you took the average, it was 2 million times a year. So we have to ask ourselves, why did she go and pick this one study that said only 65,000 times a year, and what's wrong with that study? Well, if she had read Gary Kleck's book, he very openly talks about the survey that drove that lowball study. So the author, in essence, just said, okay, I cannot accept that guns are used 2.5 million times a year to prevent crime, so I'm going to find the lowest number I can possibly find and only present those two as my proof points about the gun control debate. And, you know, if she did it intentionally, then she should be banned from writing articles for the rest of time.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows the you know, the biased ways that they conduct these polls, these scientific experiments. It reminds me of you know, during the last election cycle, when all the polls showed Hillary Clinton, you know, had 100% favorability rating, and nobody liked Donald Trump. And, you know, you find out that they skew the polls by taking, oversampling Democrats 80% to, you know, 20% independents. And then they get those skewed results. And I mean, that's kind of a bad analogy, but it is shocking to see, especially not only gun control, we have the same problem with global warming and the, NOAA being caught manipulating temperature data in order to skew the numbers to make it look like the warming trends were happening much faster. These people are exactly what you described as the, you know, manipulators and purveyors of propaganda. And the issue we're talking about is pertaining to gun control. And it is just amazing to me that in America, how old is this country? 241 years, something along those lines. We have had this constitution where the rights are granted not by government, but to the people to protect us from the government. And we are, you know, these people are halfway there in being able to manipulate the minds of the Americans into thinking that this, the Second Amendment needs to be regulated and taken away, or special provisions have, need to be put on it. And just look at some of the countries in Europe and in Australia where they had gun rights and since have had those taken away. And yet there is still gun violence there perpetrated by criminals, but there are no one left to defend. Even the police officers in some of these European countries don't carry guns. And it's just absolutely crazy. But the gun facts, the ebook that you talk about, if we can go over this a little bit, when we see all these different ways that we are being manipulated into believing that gun control is the answer, where are some of the areas that you think people who advocate for the Second Amendment can poke the most holes in these arguments? And what are some of the ways that these people, maybe behind the scenes, are coming after our gun rights that we don't even know about?
Well, the first and the most obvious is, what is the definition of something? In the same article in Unscientific American, right in paragraph number 3, after a couple of fluff paragraphs, the author talked about the 30,000 gun deaths every year in America. And your savvy listeners probably already recognize that 66% of those gun deaths were suicides. And that number also includes legal interventions, gun accidents, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the fact that right off the bat, you know, people are changing the mental definition of what a gun death is. The average citizen thinks gun death equals murder. They don't think gun death equals suicide. And this artificial inflation of the numbers is almost the central theme behind the propagandists on the pro-control side. They want people to believe that the situation is dire, desperate, that the numbers are huge, and that everyone's in danger because of it. And the problem with, you know, the way people present numbers, the way they misrepresent studies, et cetera, is that the average American doesn't have time, and likely doesn't have the expertise, to drill down to these studies and dissect them and figure out what's wrong. And that's pretty much all Gun Facts does, is that we rip into the data and we give people, you know, honest perspective, whether it's pro-gun or anti-gun. The motto of the Gun Facts project is that we're not pro-gun or anti-gun, we're pro-math and anti-BS. So that's foremost what it is. If somebody is throwing out big, scary-sounding numbers and making it sound like a dire crisis, then you're pretty much guaranteed that it's not. The second thing that people need to know, and this, I think, is becoming much more important in the debate, is that internationally speaking, America does not have a high homicide rate. If you look at all countries, we're down in the noise level. And the worst of the worst countries, the Somalias, the Rwandas, places like that, they don't even report their crime statistics. So, you know, there's some great outliers there. If we look at just industrialized countries, we do have a high homicide rate, but we don't have the highest many years. And here's the big gotcha. We have an outsized gang problem in the United States. To give you an idea, the gang participation rate, the number of people with inside of a city who are members of a street gang, is about, if I remember correctly, 700 times larger in Chicago than it is in London. And they have roughly equivalent populations. That gives you an idea of the relative difference that America has in terms of the central place where gun violence is committed. For example, Las Vegas, the mass killer, killed about 59 people, I think is the final count. That's a month in the south side of Chicago, and that happens every month of every year. And it's all centered around these street gangs where there are many people playing, and though I can't find any international studies to help back this up, I have a hunch that American street gangs have a much more lethal creed than their European cohorts. So you take a lot more people running in gangs with a much more violent ideology, and you put them in these major cities where the politicians really just don't give a darn about poor people in general, except at election time, and you're going to have a high gun homicide rate simply due to the gangs. And here's my data point. Data's a couple years old, but still relevant. The top 20 cities for homicides in America, 20 cities, have only 7% of the population, but they account for 21% of all the homicides.
Wow.
So imagine that. Almost one-fifth of the homicides created in places where you have only 7% of the population.
Yeah. And this is why we see some of these law enforcement tactics that are you know, high police areas where, you know, the most concentration of gun crimes receives the most officers on patrol, and they have, you know, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, not to skip around too much, Guy, is the equipment and technology called spot shotter. I'm not sure how familiar with this you are, but in over 70 or 80 cities in the last 10 years, they have been installing equipment around you know, these major cities to be able to triangulate and pinpoint where a gunshot has come from, and they've used this technology all over the place. They use it in Chicago, and this way, when a gunshot goes off, they can basically boil the location down to a half of a city block as to where that shot came from. Are you familiar with that technology?
I am, and as a matter of fact, right down the road in Santa Cruz, California, I believe is where some of that technology was developed. But to my mind, it's just the wrong approach. Once the gun is fired, the crime is committed.
Right.
And what we as a society are interested in doing is getting people to quit killing each other. What I have been studying, and I haven't been studying it long enough to have any, you know, solid footing on this, but what I'm seeing is that when localities take a position of intervention, and it doesn't almost matter what kind of intervention. It can be just about anything that gets between a angry, disenfranchised, testosterone-soaked young man running with street gangs and get him out of the mode that's a good option for him. it tends to reduce the violent crime. I was living in Richmond, Virginia when they launched Project Exile. It worked like a champ. And the people who say it doesn't work never looked at the data and never really understood the way the program worked. But the whole point of Project Exile was to make the cost-benefit ratio of shooting somebody as part of street violence to go completely the opposite way. If you're busted, you're going to jail. You're going to jail in a federal prison. It will be on the other side of the country where none of your family and homeboys are. And they publicized it so well that everybody on the streets got the message real fast. That worked. In some localities, they're doing street-level, evangelism, basically. They're going down to the gangbangers, and they're trying to coach them on what they can do differently, how they can get out of this lifestyle. That's effective. So, tracing where a gun was fired is infinitely useless compared to going out and getting these young men to just quit being violent.
Yeah, that's the... that's what, hopefully one day we'll figure out how to do that. As you said, many people, when looking at the statistics of gun violence and shootings, just as your website points out, don't think about the suicide aspect of that, and that's really high. I'm surprised, 80% in Canada. And then you have the gang-on-gang type violence. And when you boil it down to how many crimes are committed by guns, but by just an average citizen on another citizen, it's relatively low compared to the population that we have. And even, compared to the murder rates 25 years ago, there has been a steep decline in gun violence in this country. So we're on the right track. We just got to figure out, a better way. But it's hard when you have, scandals like the Fast and Furious ones, where the government's funneling guns to Mexican drug cartels. And I've read stories from Chicago where some gangbangers wake up in the morning to go in their turf and they find a crate of unused AR-15 sitting in an alleyway. So we have to look at all the different angles. At the same time, much of the government will advocate for gun control. They're the ones supplying guns to the criminals that are being used, that they turn around and then use those excuses as why they need gun control. It really is a psychological warfare operation against the American people.
Well, it is intriguing because, any good doctor will tell you you can treat the symptom or you can treat the disease. And if you go and you treat the disease, you will have a long-term cure. The disease that we have in America tied to the gangs is cultural. It is, and I invite anyone to fire up Google and look at the gang subcultures. Even the people in gangs have their own websites and they promote their lifestyle, and it is hideous, it is violent, it is sociopathic, and it all comes very much from the ground up. Once the seed of society doesn't care about us and we're going to rule the streets the way that we see fit becomes the commonplace within inside of a community, it's real easy for a young man to slip into that mentality, to say, this is what all my peers do, I'm never going to escape this neighborhood, I might as well go out with this gang where at least I have this Sato family and I can make money on the side and have something that resembles, activity and, the self-acknowledgement that, I have some sort of power in the world. And if we address that cultural issue, if we made it just completely repugnant to even think about being in a gang, if there was some way that we could do that, the gang problem would kind of go away and all the firearm homicide would go away with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. We have about 11 minutes left in the interview, and I want you to tell our audience about your book, Shooting the Bull. Can you give our audience an overview of what the book's about and, what you document in the book?
The book is about being able to recognize propaganda in real time. The propaganda analysis is a very arcane study, and I would not want to drag anyone through it. But to be able to recognize the ways people lie to you is very convenient. You can sit and the one thing that will do if you read Shooting the Bull is you will never be able to watch a news broadcast again without cringing, because you will be spotting misinformation and distortions one after another all night long. So when you read Shooting the Bull, not only are you going to get an end-to-end lesson about the gun control industry and, you know, how they've attempted to mislead the American public, but you also are going to get point-by-point lessons on this is how they lied, this is what the lie is called, this is how you recognize it in the future. And I would encourage anyone to read the book, whether you're pro-gun or anti-gun, it doesn't matter. Read it so that you understand how you're being misinformed. Because the one thing which I know for certain is that the media is no longer in control of the public conversation. We have wrested that away from them thanks to the internet and the ability for anyone to communicate with anyone else in this world. And you need to be able to debunk the media's propaganda. You need to be able to debunk the opposition's propaganda. And Shooting the Bull is going to be a real handy guide for you to be able to do that instantly.
Okay. And that's, folks, if you want the book, go to gunfacts.info, and on the main page, on the homepage, if you scroll down, you will see the cover, Shooting the Bull. And it has a number of our listeners' favorite characters on the cover, from Dianne Feinstein to Barack Obama. I think that's Rosie O'Donnell holding an RPG. I'm not sure they're on the right-hand side of the cover, but I like that. I like that cover. It's
I think it is, and a friend of mine said it was the ugliest book cover he ever saw.
I want to ask you something about the concealed carry in this country. Now, we know that each state has different laws and regulations and things you have to go through for concealed carry. Do you believe in the Second Amendment, that the Second Amendment, that there should be a need for licensing to conceal carry, or do you believe that the Second Amendment provides that provision that Americans should be able to, if they're able to own the gun and they have the right to bear arms, that they should not have to go and get a license to carry concealed?
That's an interesting question. And before I answer that directly, the one big court case that's going to be coming up to the Supremes pretty soon is, what does the right to bear arms mean? And it would only require Supreme Court justice and their linguistic skills to divide the right that says keep and bear arms into two separate rights. But don't put it past them. They're clever people up at the Supreme Court. But to my reading of the origin of the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms is not tied to militia duty. It is very much tied to self-protection and in the public space, because bearing arms in your private home is just, you know, a silly notion. Everyone can get their mind around that PDQ. So the question then devolves to, can you license any right? And the general principle of law in the United States is that so long as the licensing problem does not present any undue burden or delay, then government has the authority to put some sort of licensing on it. But I'm going to maintain that it's unnecessary. And the reason I'm going to maintain that is that we have a number of states in the nation that are so-called constitutional carry states or permitless carry states. You do not need to go get a license to carry a concealed weapon in public. And even though the trend is kind of new and we only have a handful of states, I've run the numbers and I'm not seeing any covariance to violence whatsoever. There is no indicator that constitutional carry makes the situation any worse. So I think we're going to end up discovering what we discovered with licensed concealed carry, and that it doesn't present a problem. And we're going to end up seeing more and more states recognize that criminals don't go out and get licenses and the good guys don't need one, so we might as well just be done with the licensing process.
Okay. Excuse me. Okay. And moving on to assault weapons, what many people call assault weapons or automatic weapons. I don't like the term assault weapons. We, not too long ago, went over the history of where the term assault weapons comes from, but many people do equate automatic weapons and some semi-automatic rifles as assault weapons. Do you believe the automatic weapons ban is unconstitutional?
That is a very good question, and I have to imagine that it is. And the reason is that everything that I've read on the founding philosophy of the Second Amendment, and by the way, if there's any history geeks out there who really want to get into this, I highly recommend a book called The Origin of the Second Amendment by Young. It's not an analysis book. It is just simply a collection of everything that was ever written about the Second Amendment during the colonial and the revolutionary period. So when we look at the origin of the Second Amendment, we find no barriers whatsoever. Let me give you my favorite example. The captains of the militia during the Revolution and all the way up to the War of 1812, etc., it was, because they tended to be the wealthier guys in the neighborhood, it was obligation for them to go out and buy cannons to serve in the militia. Well, at the end of whatever war they were fighting, those cannons went back to their homes. In fact, if you go down the James River in Virginia and some of the ancient plantations that are still there, you'll see those cannons still sitting on the front lawns or decorations now. But the cannons were the weapons of mass destruction of their era. And no one found it peculiar that when the cannon wasn't needed in warfare, that you kept it at somebody's house. So I have to imagine that a fully automatic weapon, being both, you know, an individually held weapon, as well as something that would be suitable for militia service, has to be included as one of the protected rights. I have yet to hear a really cogent argument against that position.
Okay. And, you know, a lot of people have, and I agree, you know, that with the cannons, that, you know, if we still use cannons today, that every person should have the right to have a cannon at their house. So I guess the question would be if we're talking about, you know, where does it end? Should we be able to have flamethrowers and RPGs and, all that stuff? But, you know, I guess that's not really that important in the grand scheme of what we're talking about. But I just kind of wanted to, for perspective, to kind of understand where you're coming from in, you know, all these different, the way that they've broken down the Second Amendment and classify everything and then make certain things illegal. And they continue to, one thing's for sure, as you say, they continue to attack the Second Amendment. No other amendment in the Constitution is attacked more than the Second Amendment. Even with all their pushing towards gun control, do you see a time where they will be successful and the American people will turn their guns in?
I'm going to answer that question in reverse. There will never be a time when the American people turn their guns in. One of the more interesting pieces of information I've stumbled across in recent years is the non-compliance rate internationally of people and guns. In other words, who's keeping guns illegally in their house? And it's staggering. All over the world where there is strict gun control, you got to jump through multiple hurdles just to own a pea shooter. It doesn't matter. People have guns in their home. In fact, I had a guest blogger at the Gun Facts site. She comes from the Ukraine, and she said there's an old joke out here in the Ukraine where Vladimir leaves his house and he sees Igor, his neighbor, pouring motor oil on the flower bed, and he said, "What are you doing? The oil is going to kill your flowers." And Igor says, "Yes, but my machine gun won't rust." Americans will never give up their guns. It's just not in our DNA. So it almost doesn't really matter what laws pass. But the trajectory of public opinion is such that I don't think anyone is going to put up with any legislative body banning guns. Now, that's not going to keep the other side from trying, but I see their prospects dwindling. And assuming that another couple of Supreme Court justices vacate the court or pass away within inside the next 3 years, and looking over the roster of judges that Trump has proposed and great lead off, of course, I have a feeling that the Supreme Court level blockade is going to become ever more resilient and more pro-gun. And if he can find more justices like Gorsuch and put them in the federal courts, pray God, put some on the Ninth Circuit Court, then gun legislation coming up from the states is just never going to see the light of day.
Yeah, and I hope you're right. Guy Smith is our guest. We only have about 40 seconds left. His website, gunfacts.info. Again, his book, Shooting the Bull, and you can get that on his website, as well as a free book, ebook, Gun Facts, Returning Honesty to the Gun Control Debate. Guy, thank you so much for joining us. Anything else that you want to promote or point attention to for people out there listening?
I just want to say that the Gun Facts website has everything that's in the book. You can get the book on Amazon if you want, and the website's formatted so that if you need to bring it up on your cell phone during a city council meeting, everything formats nicely for you, and you can debunk mythology on the spot.
Awesome. Guy Smith, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day and joining us tonight. It was a great conversation, and hopefully we will have you back on here in the near future. You have a great evening.
You too, and thank you again.
All right, we will be right back after this network break. We will be joined by John Rappaport of NoMoreFakeNews.com. Stay tuned.
Greenovative. Go to HagmanReport.com. Click on the link to Greenovative. What Greenovative is, it's a small company in Florida. They created something called the G-Mag Power Cell. It produces electricity by adding salt water to this unit that recharges rechargeable batteries. It's the coolest thing you'll ever see in your life. It's really neat. Really a super device. All right, you need just 2 teaspoons of ordinary table salt, a little water, but a bang, you're charging your rechargeable batteries. Super G-Mag Chargeable is affordable, it's lightweight, weighs about 8 ounces, it's durable, it's EMP proof, and it's environmentally friendly, that it is. It'll provide safe and convenient power for recharging 6 AA batteries off the grid when other power sources aren't available anywhere, anytime, in any weather, day or night. Go to greeninnovative.com. That's greeninnovative.com. Folks, in these uncertain times, it just makes sense to have a sustainable backup method for accomplishing one of life's most important tasks, and that's preparing food. This is the way to go. There is nothing better than a Minuteman rocket stove from MinutemanStove.com. We all need a way to cook and a method to process water. I mean, think about it. Think about the many things that could happen to you. Minuteman rocket stove can provide your family or group the perfect solution. It's small, lightweight, wood-burning, and every bit as powerful as a kitchen stove. It's smoke. Fully self-contained for clean storage and transport. Because it's so efficient, it cuts down on your wood gathering and processing chores to a tenth what would be required if cooking the old-fashioned way over an open fire. So don't rely on gas or fuel stoves. Prepare your family. Prepare for yourself. Order a Minuteman rocket stove today. It's going to make bad times much better. Folks, MinutemanStove.com. MinutemanStove.com. Need I say more?
You should have a Minuteman, the survival stove in an ammo can.
For investors, timberland has become the symbol of safety. Global tropical timber demand continues to surge as the world's population increases. The need for managed, sustainable timber production forests has never been greater. When stock markets crash, trees keep growing. Direct ownership of fully managed tropical timberland acreage is now available to accredited investors. Prime, valuable hardwood groves close to the beautiful Costa Rican border generate and maintain superior long-term wealth. Consider visiting our forest forest plantations. Qualified accredited investors should go to PreciousTimberProfits.com or dial 855-888-6288 for more information. Call 855-888-6288 or visit PreciousTimberProfits.com. This announcement does not constitute either an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offering made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288, PreciousTimberProfits.com. Precious Timber Profits.